Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online Editor-in-Chief, Rich Dries.
And seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online Contributing Editor, Natasha Bogutsky. How's it going, Natasha?
It's not going too bad. How'd I do there? I've been trying to switch it up every single time I say it. There's only so many times you can say that opening before.
I know.
But speaking of openings.
Yes.
I wanted to talk a little bit this week about film openings.
You have been doing a lot of that on Disney Plus, haven't you?
Maybe.
You told me the other night you've been watching a lot of your favorite films in just the first 5-10 minutes.
Yes.
Okay, why?
Because a film itself can be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But the opening of a movie, particularly prior to your opening credits, your title card, sometimes can make the movie. It's the whole setup. If you don't have a good opening, you're screwed.
Mm-hmm. You don't catch the audience. It's like writing the lead paragraph in a newspaper story or a magazine article or the first chapter of a book.
Exactly. One of the films that I came across, which I have not watched in God, years. Dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an underrated movie from the early aughts of Disney's films. And the opening is so good. It's right after you hit your title card. That's when it really gets good for the, say, like, it's the first 7.5 minutes of the film. So from the moment that the Disney logo pops up to about 7.5 minutes into the film. You're already past your title card at that point. But you follow this long journey of this sole surviving egg from the destruction of its nest by a Carnotaur. And it travels across the world. Because, you know, one dinosaur picks it up, thinks it's going to be food, starts fighting with another one of its kind. It goes over a cliff, lands on a little river, and it follows down this river like a underwater creature, swallows it, mm-hmm. doesn't like it, so pukes it back out, pops up over the water. Then you have these two bear-like creatures who are on rocks in the middle of this stream, yipping and yipping at each other as the damn egg goes right between them. And they stare at it for a second, and then they start going back at each other. And then you have a bunch of, you know, triceratops who are, you know, drinking out of the stream, and the egg is just rolling around until a pterodactyl picks it up and takes off with it. Goes down a waterfall, across the land, underneath these dinosaurs, and then out to this little island in the middle of nowhere. And the music that swells in the background behind it, it just, that's all you need. You show your journey, you show your antagonist, you sort of introduce us to the protagonist, who is the little one in the egg,
mm-hmm.
and you show us our world.
Yes,
it's the whole setup.
It's a remarkable bit of world building through just showing you this thing. And it's only, what, about 4 minutes?
Mm-hmm. No, that section?
Mm-hmm.
I'd say it's about 4, maybe 5 minutes.
Okay.
It's so good. There's a reason why when they were promoting the movie, they actually release that was your first look at this film, was they released that whole 5 minute section on one of the VHS tapes that I had when I was a kid. I don't remember if it was Atlantis or The Emperor's New Groove or something, but it was on one of those tapes, and I remember seeing it and just being swept away by this majesty of this world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, you're trying to sell to dinosaurs to kids, which is going to be an easier sell than, you know, sitting them down to watch Jurassic Park. And you're doing it very well. It was also one of the first major CGI films post Toy Story. And you can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things I caught the other night when I went back to watch it. And I discussed this with you off the podcast. Was that you, now looking back on it, there's something a little off about the CGI on the scales. But it still holds up after almost 20 years.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing how some CGI that's 20 years old, like this, or, again, dinosaurs, Jurassic Park. I think the first Jurassic Park, the CG holds up amazingly well.
But also, you had a lot more practical effects on that.
Yeah,
a lot more animatronics.
Yeah, there was a nice mix in there. But still, that first shot of, like, when they come around in the Jeeps and they see, you know, the field and all the brachiosaurs eating from the trees and everything. It's amazing.
Again, with huge swelling music in the background. Mm-hmm.
Some great John Williams score there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the opening moments of a film have got to work. Otherwise, you're just going to check out. And the best ones always kind of help set the stage in ways that you might not even realize. My favorite example is always the opening of Star Wars. You're sitting there, you get the scroll, you pan down through the stars, and you know, you're above Tatooine there, and you don't know what planet that is. It's just an alien planet of some sort. And then whoosh, the rebel blockade runner flies overhead and it's firing back at somebody. It's like, oh, okay, here's some guys and they're being chased. And oh, here's the other ship that's chasing them, and it starts to come into view, and it's the Star Destroyer. And it keeps coming into view, and it keeps coming into view. And as the Rebel Blockade Runner gets smaller and smaller as it speeds away into the distance, or tries to, the Star Destroyer just keeps coming and coming. And oh my gosh, is this ship ever going to end? How big is this freaking thing? It's ridiculous. And then that's where you realize that's how they're setting up the stakes of the movie, that the rebellion is just a small group of people, small bunch of scrappy folks who are fighting back at this enormous, gigantic military machine, both figuratively and literally, that they, you know, and you're like, these people don't have a hope in hell at winning against this. And I think that sets up a lot of the movie's dramatic tension in that just one amazing visual element that captured everybody's imagination when it first started to unravel on screens in 1977.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's just so much. I just feel like to do a film right, you have to have a good opening.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've been making our movies,
mm-hmm.
I think that's something that I wasn't paying attention to all that much. We are lacking in our opening sections.
maybe we can say that there are slightly different rules for short films, because both of our things so far are only about 20 minutes each.
That is a rule, though, that I caught when I wrote Cabaret Crime.
Mm-hmm.
Is that I gave us a good opening moment.
Yeah, you have a great opening moment. A lot of movies open with that, like an action beat, like you have set up for, you know, the feature. You don't know. I don't want to talk too much about our own projects and give stuff away, but but you see that a lot in a lot of movies where you start off with an action beat. So like some of the Lethal Weapon films always start off with like an action beat and then they introduce the story.
Mm-hmm. Sticking with some of the Disney stuff, one of the ones I made mention of the other night to you was Mulan.
Mm-hmm. Action beat.
And very much an action beat. You introduce your antagonist, Shan Yu, who is bringing his Mongolian Huns to conquer China, attack the Great Wall. There's your first action. You have a scrappy little soldier
mm-hmm.
running through the whole fight to grab a torch, take it up to the top, and he drops it, setting off all the beacons across China to let them know about the attack. And that's when Shan Yu first appears, falcon on his arm. Nice little drums. Boom, boom, boom. Walks up to him and the scrappy little soldier looks at him and goes, "Now all of China knows you're here." Shan Yu breaks the flag, lowers it over the fire to let the Chinese flag burn, and goes, "Perfect."
Yeah.
And then, that's your opening. Mm-hmm. And that film came out in, what, 98? And I saw it in the cinema. And even as a kid, I was just like, that's it. I'm in. I'm in for the long ride. And I was a little tipsy the other night when I was doing this. And I rewatched Atlantis, The Lost Empire, at least like the first 15 minutes of it. In the opening section, I sent you it at one point. Those little, I don't want to call them planes or...
Little skimmer.
Yeah, like... Yeah. Little speeders. Yeah, there we go. Okay. We're going to use Star Wars terminology here. There, these, you have a giant wave coming down to crush Atlantis. You have mm-hmm. these little speeder pilots who are trying to get back to the city to warn everyone that destruction is coming. And at one point, those things are fucking moving. Yep. I am terrified watching that they are going to crash into something. And I think it might have been because I was a little tipsy and I hadn't watched it in a while, but I went, holy shit.
You were really into that.
I was. I really mm-hmm. was. So, yeah, I would definitely say when you're watching a movie, pay very close attention to the opening, because your opening could be the best part of your movie.
True. And, I'm going to just briefly hit on this because I've talked about it before on the show. The opening 18 minutes of Speed Racer.
I haven't seen Speed Racer, so I can't have an opinion on that one.
But that opening 18 minutes, they introduce the world and how maybe physics is a slightly different with the way these cars work. But they also kind of go back and forth between speed now in a race and gives you so much of the backstory of his family. And a lot of the familial relationships and how those work through a series of flashbacks that are all part of the race that he is in the present time of the movie. And it's a very complicated web of exposition that they're giving you, but it's done so well visually. It's very exciting, and it's an amazing bit of filmmaking. And I think, you know, the rest of the film is... I really enjoy as well, but I don't think it ever works as just so technically brilliant as those 18 minutes. And those could almost function as that whole segment could function as its own short film if it needed to.
You segued us into live actions. Mm-hmm. So I would definitely say Dark Knight.
Oh gosh. Yeah. As
a very strong opening. You introduce Joker, you set your stakes. You also show a little bit of the corruption and the filthy money and where it's being hid. So, yeah, I would definitely say that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great grabber.
And that line when he removes the mask for the first time and he says, you know, whatever doesn't kill you only makes you, pulls it off, stranger. And you're like, oh, shit, we're in.
Yep.
We're definitely in on that one. I know it's more of a dramatic opening, the opening of The Social Network, the breakup scene.
Oh, yeah.
With him and Rooney Mara. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's legendary that it's known that it took 99 takes to get that right. And the banter back and forth is just, it's so good.
Very much so, but yes.
And another action opening, Matrix, with Trinity.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. Sometimes it's good to have a really strong opening with an action beat. Mm-hmm. Even Trainspotting, the whole Choose Life speech at the beginning of the film.
Mm-hmm. Trainspotting. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels from Guy Ritchie.
Oh,
also
yes.
Has a
very
strong
good.
Opening, you know, very similar to Trainspotting.
I'm trying to think of a good Tarantino one. Inglourious Basterds.
Okay.
The whole speech, that's the speech, the whole tension dialogue scene with Christoph Waltz.
And the farmer?
Yes.
Amazing. And that's something that also could function almost as its own short film.
Mm-hmm.
So.
It's so strong, and it's how far can you pull that tension rubber band before it snaps?
Very much so.
And, of course, how could you forget The Lion King? Bringing us back around to animation and Disney.
Yeah.
The opening of Lion King is just so iconic mm-hmm. That even when they did the live action, if you don't get that right shot for shot and drop that title card perfectly,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have people who riot. There's a reason why when I was sitting there in the theater, and I don't like Lion King. I let me just preface this by saying I'm not a fan.
Mm-hmm.
But I admire the opening. So when we went to see it, the live action version.
The quote unquote live action version.
Didn't I audibly went yes when they dropped the title card?
Yes, you did. I was just impressed with like the rack focus from the ants on
the zebra,
the branch down to the zebra. I was like, okay, if you're replicating that, you know, I'm in for at least what you're trying to do. Even though I felt ultimately it was just not worth it. I give them credit where credit is due on some of that stuff. But one of the most important things about your opening scene is not overstaying your welcome. And we're not going to overstay our welcome on this segment.
No, we are going to get right into the meat of our story. And hopefully it doesn't take us 3.5 hours to get through it.
Oh, good gosh, no. We got things to do today.
Mm-hmm.
And that meat, though, is our review of Martin Scorsese's 3.5 hour gangster epic.
That takes place locally to us.
Well, portions of it does, yes.
Portions of it, yeah.
And that's The Irishman. And we'll be right back with our review of that in just a moment. Although he has directed both documentaries and feature films in a number of genres, director Martin Scorsese is perhaps best known for his gangster films. Sprawling tales set in various points of 20th century America, his films not only examine the rise and fall of criminals and their empires, but how those stories reflected the changing social and economic landscape of the country. From the late 19th century setting of Gangs of New York to the Depression-era Boxcar Bertha, which Scorsese made for exploitation maestro Roger Corman in 1972, to the 1960s and 70s organized crime saga Goodfellas, to robber barons of the 1980s and Wolf of Wall Street, Scorsese has told stories of those pursuing the American dream of success and fortune just on the wrong side of the law. His latest film, The Irishman, is something of a culmination of these films. Starring Robert De Niro, the film tells the mostly true story of a World War II veteran who stumbles his way into the Philadelphia Mafia, slowly rising in its ranks until he becomes assigned to bodyguard the firebrand Jimmy Hoffa, played by Al Pacino. So, Natasha.
Yes.
Where does The Irishman fit into Martin Scorsese's overall body of work? Is it just another gangster film?
No.
Or is it more?
No, I think it's the culmination of all of his work.
Okay. So we're on board for that. You're on board with me on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, it is. It very much is. I think it's a movie that only Martin Scorsese could make, and only at this point in his career could he make this movie.
Yeah. When he was younger, I think he may have overlooked a lot of the emotional beats of that comes with wisdom and age. For more flashy, fun, in-your-face dialogue and action.
Okay, yeah, I would agree with you there. And also, I think...
Because I went back and I rewatched Goodfellas recently.
Mm-hmm.
They don't compare. It's almost like they're completely two different styles.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is much more contemplative in how this looks at these characters. Because we're basically seeing their story being told from their own old age. They know that, you know, they've lived this life and they're looking back on it and they're thinking about it and they know that they did not live good lives. They did not do good works. They know that they chose a certain lifestyle and it had its risks and it had its almost guarantees that it was not going to end well for anybody.
No.
And the fact that they managed to, you know, live out to their old age is a
a rare blessing.
A rare blessing, yes, that none of their contemporaries, none of the other people they worked with, you know, had the luxury of. The movie very much makes a point of telling you when a new character comes in, boom.
This is how they died.
Yeah, this is how this person's going to die. You know,
and when.
Yeah, 5 shots to the face while walking through an alley and December of 1980 or whatever.
Shot five times in the face in his kitchen.
Yes. All sorts of things like that. So you know that, because sometimes you don't actually see that. You know, these characters just kind of come into the story and then go back out. But, you know, since we're being told this story from the viewpoint of De Niro's Frank's character as an old man in a retirement home, basically, you kind of get that. It's a visual way of doing the kind of digression you would maybe get when you're talking to somebody in their 80s and they're telling you a story. I was like, oh, yeah, and then this person, you know, kind of was part of the story for a little bit. Then he disappears out of the story. Eh, he eventually got shot in the face. And anyways, back to the story. You know, it's a kind of a visual way of doing one of those little mini digressions you would probably get when you're sitting there talking to a grandfather or your grandmother or somebody like that, and they're telling that kind of a story. And I think, though, there's a reflection in this movie as they're looking back as part of the structure that I don't think Scorsese, as a younger man, as a younger director, would have been able to execute as well.
No. A lot of, like I said, I think part of it comes from age and wisdom and looking back even on his own life and mm-hmm. seeing maybe in the works that he's done before things that he's done wrong. And he knows how to correct them. Which, one of the best scenes in the film you and I talk about is happens inside a kitchen.
Yes.
Over making a bowl of salad. And it's so beautifully constructed.
Between De Niro and Pesci.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so beautifully constructed and understated, too.
Yeah.
They're talking about something that needs to be done. And, you know, don't want to go into spoilers because this is kind of almost third act at this point.
Yeah.
They're talking about something that needs doing
that they care about.
Yeah. But it's, they don't want to talk about it. They're just kind of like, one character is very matter of fact that it needs to be done and has kind of emotionally distanced himself from that decision. And is just telling the other character that this needs to be done and is trying to say, look, it's going to be them or us. And
this is going to happen. Don't tell them.
Yeah. Don't call them. And it's an amazing moment because of its complexity, its subtlety.
And De Niro sells it.
Yes. De Niro amazingly sells it.
He doesn't say a word. And you can read everything on his face.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of it, is that you can read all the conflict and the hurt and the pain and the betrayal
mm-hmm.
right there. Tell us a little bit about what the story is about.
Well, the story is about a truck driver from Philadelphia who has a chance encounter with Russell Bufalino, who is a kind of a big cheese in organized crime in Pennsylvania.
He's the underboss.
And who just happens to have lived in the Wilkes-Barre Scranton area where we record out of. So that was fun to hear, you know, a couple of local places mentioned in the movie. And basically, we witness it, De Niro's character, Frank Sheeran, his rise through this organized crime organization until he is kind of given the task of working with labor organizer Jimmy Hoffa. And this is, of course, based all on the actual book, I Heard You Paint Houses, and by Chris Brandt.
I know this is going to sound like a strange question.
Hmm.
Was the title of this film possibly changed?
To The Irishman?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I was going to say, because there is actual no title card on the movie that says The Irishman. It says, I Heard You Paint Houses.
Yeah, I don't understand why they do that. Why at the beginning we get I Heard You Paint Houses as a title card, but it doesn't say The Irishman. And I believe it says The Irishman, though, at the end credits.
I think it does. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not sure why they kind of do it that way. It's struck me as odd.
Is this maybe a stylistic choice?
I don't know. Again, you know, it's something that's like the one thing I haven't been able to wrap my head around from this movie. And, you know, I'm like, I'm not sure that's that important.
I know, but it was just one of those things that popped out at me. And I'm just like, I got to remind myself to think about this.
Exactly. But I like the structure of this movie, you know, as told in flashback.
Yes.
It kind of, it mostly tells the story in a proper progression. And honestly, though, some of the flashbacks are within flashbacks and things like that. And if you sat down and tried to chart it, you'd probably look at it and go, yikes, how does this work? But I think it works really well.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's, you know, you've got, you know, Scorsese directing it, and editing was Thelma Schumacher. So, you know, that's, you know, well in your favor when you have her in the editing room for you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this film is like an editing map of how you should do it.
Gosh, yes.
You want to talk about that comic moment?
There's a few comic moments in here, and that's, again, just through the actions of these people, not actual yuck-yuck gags.
They love the word cocksucker in this film, by the way.
Yes. And there's one moment, though, that there's a great laugh that comes from editing, and I don't want to give it away, but it just, you know, a scene is building to a certain amount of tension, and then there's a cut.
And they're in a car.
Two people are in a car. And
you see the bruises.
Somebody is bruised, and it's hilarious. And you just, the way it's juxtaposed against what was leading up to that previous scene, and then boom, that edit, you know, and everybody just laughs. It's a great cathartic moment there. But I want to kind of talk to you about for a moment.
Yes.
About the one thing that kind of kept this movie from being made for a while. Because of the expense, and I want to ask how it worked for you. And I'm talking about the de-aging.
Yeah. After the first 15 minutes, I didn't notice it was there.
Okay. But the first 15 minutes, though?
First 15 minutes, it's good. But like with any CGI on a person, you're always going to have a little bit of... That looks slightly plasticky.
It doesn't quite clear the uncanny valley for you?
It's not supposed to. Our software hasn't reached that point yet where it's absolutely perfect. And it's just because there are things about human skin that is a little... It's hard to replicate. Even when you're talking prosthetics... Prosthetic, you are more likely to get across because you can physically map the makeup. Whereas with CGI and with, you know, special effects, those little details can sometimes be missed because they're not that close. But there are times where it works.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, the first Ant-Man movie. When Michael Douglas walks on the screen in the opening in the 80s and you see him and I went, whoa. I thought that they had copied him right out of Wall Street. It was that good. But then when you see him again in Endgame, it wasn't as good. And maybe it's because my brain was already expecting it.
Or it might have been a case where they just didn't have the budget to do as much work in Endgame.
Maybe. And I think that's another problem here is that the de-aging at the beginning has to be a lot more than midway through the film or closer to the end of the film. You could tell the rest of that is a little bit of de-aging and more makeup effects throughout the movie, more practical. At the beginning, you have to do a lot because you're going back, 40, 50 years almost,
mm-hmm.
something like that. So you're gonna have a lot of work that needs to be done there. And maybe Netflix just didn't have the budget to work with, like a Marvel movie does to do that.
Well, this was $150 million, the budget on this thing.
Okay, so
and
maybe...
A big chunk of that was allegedly for stuff like that, but they also shot this thing in just 170 days or something. It was a ridiculously fast... It's like 170 scenes, and they shot it in 177 days.
That's nuts.
Like. Yeah, it was something, one of those kind of crazy things, because at some point, because there's sometimes like cutaway shots... that are in like a location and it's on screen for 30 seconds and they never go back to that location. And my brain goes, that took half a day to do. That right there was a half or a full day right there for that 30-second cutaway that maybe could have been lost in an editing room.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't want to say I was distracted by thinking about the process of this movie, but at some point I was thinking about the process of this movie because it's so sprawling and so complex and how they managed to do that. And it was more out of admiration that they managed to do everything that they did in this thing. But to talk about the editing for a moment, somebody had said to me that they thought it could have been trimmed a little bit. I can see you thinking about that, and while you are for a moment,
I'm trying to think if there is a spot where you could trim, and I don't think you can.
No, I like the fact that sometimes we sit with these characters for a little bit, and we're spending time with these characters because ultimately this is a story about their lives over decades. So the longer we sit with them, the longer we get that idea of the time that has passed through their life.
You go through the shades of age and maturity and their relationships, and you almost feel like you've been with the characters that entire time.
Oh yeah,
you feel like you've aged along with them, and I think that's the point. There were a couple of scenes where you would think, okay, maybe they could go, like in the jewelry shop where they're shopping for the gift on the ride.
And yeah,
but
just kind of dressing down like the owner's son.
But that needs to stay. Why? Because they're all the way out past Ohio at this point. That shows that his, how they respect him and his power stretches that far.
Mm-hmm.
Even with just little local shops, you kind of need to understand the realm of power around the country and how far someone's influence can stretch, even with like just your everyday Joe Schmoes. And so yeah, that even scenes like that need to stay.
Yeah, and that's why I think actually seeing it in a theater is probably a better idea than watching it on Netflix.
Thank God we saw it twice in the theater.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I feel very blessed for that.
Yes, seven hours worth of Scorsese's The Irishman in under 28 hours. Oof. It was nuts.
But
I fulfilled a promise that I made to myself, which was the first time I saw that movie, I was going to be drinking Irishman whiskey, and they were selling it at the goddamn movie theater, which was perfect.
Oh, yes. The Belasco on Broadway, which was a great place just to see any movie.
Oh,
but the fact
beautiful.
That it was the Irishman, and it was the experience as well as the movie that made that day wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the idea that, you know, if you're watching this, and I know there had been some talk before the movie came out about, oh, this maybe should have an intermission or not. I don't think it needs an intermission. I think you need to
there's no place to put it
there. Yeah, there's no place to put it without drastically restructuring the movie.
Because you need to have a nice build, and then you can stop here, and then you come back afterwards with a little bit of a downslope, and then you build it back up for your end.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of can't do that here.
No,
because it
at all.
Flows perfectly yeah. all the way through.
Like I said, you'd have to majorly restructure the movie, and you're probably going to get a lesser product.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the fact that it's 3.5 hours and people are like, I'll just catch it on Netflix where I can pause and go to the bathroom and stuff like that. But I think, yeah, again, if you pause even on your own and just run to the bathroom, grab a drink, come back or whatever, you're going to lose a lot of that flow. And a lot of that, I think that's going to break up that feeling of sitting with these characters for a while and getting the feeling of time as it weighs on them.
Yeah.
And slightly weighs on you as you're watching it.
I'm very proud that both times I saw this film, I didn't leave the theater. But I was kind of raised on old epics. I've stated that several times
yeah.
in the podcast. Like Cleopatra, Ben-Hur, Ten Commandments, even Return of the King or Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
Those are these big, sprawling epics where you would have an intermission, where you could take a break. But I never did. I just kept going. And so I've kind of trained myself that sitting through a long movie is not a big deal. That's a problem a lot of modern audiences seem to have, is they want it force-fed to them, but in a short amount of time.
Yeah.
They don't want to wait. They don't want to take the time. They don't want to spend the time for a slow burn. And this needs to be one.
Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, people talking about run times all the time. It was like, oh, it's over 2 hours. And it's like, ugh. And I mean, there's a business consideration there.
Even songs have run times of this is how long we'll play a song on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Because they feel people's attention span isn't whatever.
So the fact that Bohemian Rhapsody still keeps going, right on. Anyway.
But I kind of reject that. I mean, if it's good and engrossing, you're not going to care unless, yeah, okay, maybe I should have not had the large soda and gulped it through the previews, knowing that this is a 3.5 hour movie. But other than that, you know, I think people are willing to sit for long movies, and they have in the past, and they, you know.
It just has to be worth sitting through.
Oh, and this is definitely worth it.
Yeah. If you're going to have a long movie, it has to be good product. You're not going to be able to churn out your easy run-of-the-mill movie that is going to make, you know, make good box office, but get like a 40% on Rotten Tomatoes and expect people to sit 3.5 hours for it. It's not going to happen. You're going to have walkouts after the first hour and a half. Maybe, all right, maybe they'll sit through your average two hours. And then they'll decide, maybe we should go. But for a movie that is good, like this, like Titanic, like Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. For crying out loud, every single Lord of the Rings film is upwards of 3 hours. You try to sit through those, you are spending at least 10 hours on the sofa that day. You will break after each movie, but you're not going to be shutting it off midway through to use the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you do like the last two Avengers movies back to back. You do Infinity War, you do Endgame. Endgame is 3 minutes too... Yeah, 302. You might break in between the movies, but you're not going to break in the movie. So it's just the product. It has to be good product.
Now this is like the longest mainstream film released in like 20 years or something crazy like that. And so I think maybe people have just... Maybe this is an example or a byproduct of streaming now that people watch so much stuff at their own home that they are used to having that control. And I think it's a good thing that they don't have that control. I think it's a good thing that they have to give themselves over to a story for that full amount of time.
Indeed. Okay. Then I have a question for you.
Okay.
Let's talk awards.
Oh, boy. Yeah, because we had a discussion about that as to what might or might happen there. Everybody involved is doing sterling work here. Amazing stuff. You can't be upset with any of it.
Mm-mm.
You can't, you know, point something out and say, well, this is lesser work. They've done better. I think everybody's at the top of their game here.
I'm tossing my hat into the ring and I'm saying Joe Pesci for supporting actor.
Oh gosh. Yes. I would love to see him nominated and yeah, he already had one before. He already received an Oscar before. But I would love to see him get another one. You know, and yeah, somebody might dismiss it as a bit of a, that's his thank you for your career Oscar, because he's basically been in retirement and he came out just for this movie and then he's going to disappear again. And then when he passes away 8 years from now, people are going to be like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that guy. What, you know, I thought he had died a while ago. He's going to have one of those passings. Unfortunately, I hate to say it. But, you know, it was like William Powell, the great William Powell. He, you know, Mr. Roberts was his last film. He quietly retired, didn't do anything, and just kind of kept out of public view. And then like 15 years later, when he did pass away, people were like, oh, I forgot he wasn't even still with us. But
like I did with Emmett Walsh last week.
Yes, pretty much. but yeah, I think, you know, Pesci should definitely be given an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting.
We're going to have an Oscar nomination for lead for Robert De Niro, obviously. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, because I think this is his best work in forever.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I've kind of gotten tired of his quote unquote comedy work. And this is a great dramatic role. And he does so much by doing so little here. It's not, you know, oftentimes we've said that best acting is not most acting. Mm-hmm. And here, this is so little acting. It's all, you know, very much reflective in his face and his eyes. He's not making...
There's a scene near the end of the film with the priest. You know which one I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That is a perfect scene of him doing so much by doing so little.
Exactly. And that's the kind of work I hope the Academy wants to recognize this year.
But our other character, played by Al Pacino, our Jimmy Hoffa, where does he fall in? Because there's going to be a nom. The question is, what freaking category? Is he a lead or is he a supporting?
I feel he's a more of a supporting character. He's not quite a lead because the movie's not about him. It's about De Niro's character of Frank. And his relationship with Jimmy Hoffa, played by Pacino, is a part of that story, but it's not the entire story. It becomes a major portion of the story. But I think there's enough other things going on in Frank's story arc that Jimmy Hoffa is not the main thrust there, so he's more of a supporting character than a lead. Do you disagree or agree?
I don't know. That's the problem I'm having. No, I agree. Story-wise, he's definitely more supporting, mm-hmm. but he gets so much runtime that he actually should be the lead. I think Pacino has more... I hate to say it. I think he actually has more screen time than De Niro.
I don't know about that. I mean, the film's so much told through Frank's perspective that I don't think the film ever gets away from his character all that much.
True, but the scenes that he's not there for, it's just narration.
Mm-hmm.
So he still tells the story even when he's not there.
Yeah. And that's why I would say that makes Pacino supporting.
Okay. All right.
Now, the question becomes, though, if Pacino is nominated and supporting along with Joe Pesci, how's that going to play out? Pacino's is a much flashier role. If you were an Academy voter or looking at how the Academy votes, do you see them giving it to Pacino? Do you see them giving it to Pesci? Or do you see both of their performances splitting votes and then somebody else who's also nominated actually winds up being the winner?
I don't know. I'm not quite certain.
I know it's tough. I don't have an answer for that.
Because I'd like to say it would be Pesci, but I think it would be Pacino. Now, if Pacino ends up in the acting category, and mm-hmm. I think you and I both have come to a common agreement on this, that Joaquin Phoenix is going to be nominated for actor for Joker, and you True. And I both know it.
Oh, gosh, yes.
I think that would be a tough call if Pacino... I do not think that De Niro will get the Academy Award. He's doing some fabulous work here, but he is not going to win it.
Against Joaquin Phoenix?
No.
And I want to just state very snarkily here, it would be weird that Joaquin Phoenix wins an acting award.
He kills De Niro again.
Well, yes, for killing De Niro again, but also for being in a movie that people have accused of being a Scorsese ripoff on certain levels. While De Niro was actually in a Scorsese film and didn't get it. So yeah, so there's that.
Okay, I can see that. That got really loud. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'll fix it in post.
No, but I can see that. But yeah, Pacino against Joaquin Phoenix. Now that would be the heat. Ah, see what I did mm-hmm. there?
Nice.
Thank Nicely you. Played. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm definitely seeing picture, director, writing, editing. What else are you seeing? Costume?
It's a historical drama, so that always gives it an in for costuming. But
I think it may make the short list, but I'm not quite certain if it'll actually make...
Yeah, historical dramas like that usually, you know, at least short list onto for costuming and production design. But yeah, I think adapted screenplay, because this structure is so very tricky... And the script by Steve Zaillian really works. I think it really sings.
Makeup and special effects.
It'll shortlist for special for visual effects, but I don't think it'll go all the way.
You don't think it'll make to a nominee?
I think if it does get to a nomination, it's going to be at least up against Star Wars.
Well, duh.
And probably
Avengers.
Avengers Endgame.
Yeah, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And Cats. Ugh. Cats will make the nomination just for its CGI work.
Mm-hmm. It depends, though, if they go 3 nominations or 5 this year for visual effects, because sometimes they only do the 3, and I can't remember what the rule is there.
Usually, when I see 3 nominations, it's usually in the makeup category,
mm-hmm.
which The Irishman will be nominated.
Oh, yeah.
And it kind of harks, and you think that most makeup is best makeup? It's not. Because a few years ago, we had the Iron Lady going up against, like, big hitters, like Star Trek and all that. And who won it? The Iron Lady.
Mm-hmm.
It's best makeup, not most makeup.
True.
It's not the most inventive, oh, let's see what creatures we can create kind of thing. No, it's what is the most realistic. Mm-hmm. And if it helps the story as well. But yeah, we're take that, Spielberg. I'm sorry. At this point, he's kind of becoming a little bit of a joke. And so if this is their way of slapping him in the face, Netflix going, bitch, we could come up with good content even more so than you can now. Then, yeah, I say right on. Right on, streaming. Because they've got this. They've got Marriage Story coming out.
The Report.
No, The Report's Amazon.
Oh, I keep doing that. I
know you keep doing that. Let's just see if in a few days from now, when it actually drops on the Amazon, if you turn on Netflix first.
I probably will. But obviously, though, you know, the purpose of making a film is not awards. Although at this time of the year, it's easy to kind of drift into that. But I think it definitely works as cinema, and it's worth seeing on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have that, you know, this is a movie that wouldn't have been made without Netflix. So I don't want to hear anybody bitching that Netflix is ruining movies, because Netflix took a chance and made this movie when all the studios wouldn't. Netflix knows this is prestige for us. We're going to get a little money back from getting it out into a small release, and then we're going to have it on our service. And people are going to come to see this movie. Our regular subscribers are already paying for content that is good, and this is a good thing. So they will already come and see this, and more people will sign up, hopefully, to see this. This is one of those bellwether movies, I think, that signal like how the industry is shifting and changing. And I'm happy with that.
It's the same.
Yeah. You know, Spielberg can kvetch all he wants and, oh, these are TV movies.
The content here, its quality proves it's not.
No.
It is a standout piece of art.
Yes. And let's not forget, Spielberg started in TV.
Yeah.
He did the pilot for Night Gallery. His movie Duel was a TV movie, but it still showed theatrically in Europe.
I think he's just more upset over the fact that the idea of quality is shifting. And his quality has gone downhill in the past 10 years. He has not come out with any great... He's doing the Tim Burton, I'm riding out on my name alone. And oof. I'm...
okay, granted, Ready Player One was not good. And it was a huge disappointment. I'll give you that. But you think Spielberg is kind of in a slump right now?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's got West Side Story coming out next year at this time. Do you think that's going to pull him out, or it's way too early to tell, though?
I think it's way too early to tell. We will see on that one. But is he directing?
Yes.
All right. I'm only counting the movies he's actually directing. Anything that he is producer on doesn't get a hit from me.
Yeah, no.
Because it's just, you're just attaching your name at that mm-hmm. point. I think the last film that he did that was good that he directed was Lincoln.
Oof, that was a little while
ago. That was 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And he had War Horse in 2011.
Okay.
Since then, he's done The 100-Foot Journey, Bridge of Spies, which was okay. It wasn't great. It was okay.
Mm-hmm. But Mark Rylance's performance was wonderful.
Oh, fantastic performance from him. The BFG. The Post.
Yeah, The Post was a bit of a disappointment, too.
Yeah. Ready Player One. Those are his films since Lincoln.
Okay.
And even before then, he did Indiana Jones, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, Munich. Munich had some good ports to it. The Terminal, Catch Me If You Can, Minority Report, AI. That goes back to the beginning of our millennia. Century.
Yeah.
You want to tell me he has done, he's... I'm sorry. No.
No, that's okay. I think, though, we can reject that and go say that The Irishman is wonderful.
Yes.
And people should see it.
And even if you have problems with Scorsese right now because of how he's responding to Marvel movies and to comic book films, also...
That's just another way, though, of somebody responding to shifts in the culture and in the industry that, you know, similar to how Spielberg, you know, was responding to Netflix movies. So it struck me as ironic that somebody who is making a wonderful piece of art with a Netflix through Netflix is kind of poo-pooing on something else instead. I mean, everybody's going to complain about something.
But yeah, everyone's going to complain about something. But here's the thing. Scorsese is actually churning out good quality.
Mm-hmm.
And he is starting to adapt. Whereas Spielberg has stuck to the blockbuster films and has not churned out good quality. And he's still poo-pooing on
other people.
On
maybe get your own
changing.
House in order a little bit, Steve?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think that just about wraps us up for this week. The Irishman is currently on Netflix streaming and will undoubtedly be coming to a number of awards shows this season.
All right. Now, remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com. And we are now available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So either use the link in the show notes post or head directly there, search, and hit subscribe.
And if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review because that always helps us connect with new listeners. We'll be back next week with another look at the week's film news.
And that's all on the Big Picture Podcast.